The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. And today I'm very excited to talk to Dylan Banerjee, who is actually a retired Foreign Service officer. So he's on the other side and he's got some free time here to tell us about his experience with the Golden Visa program. However, before we get into that, a little brief background about Dylan. He was an FSO for over 20 years, did lots of really amazing tours, Nigeria, Russia, Portugal, Mexico, India, Sweden, and was the Minister Counselor for Commercial Affairs there in Sweden, and also the acting U.S. Ambassador at a certain point before wrapping up his tour and deciding to retire. And he joins us from Geneva, Switzerland, where he's living with his family, including his wife, who's also a Foreign Service officer. And prior to joining the Foreign Service, he worked for 3 years at the Environmental Protection Agency and also served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Cameroon. And he's also the author of The Insider's Guide to the Peace Corps, which is not exactly what we're going to talk about today, but I invited Dylan on the show because he has a really interesting story and there's been a lot of interest in the Golden Visa program recently. So welcome to the show, Dylan.
Thank you, Tanya. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
And, you know, I would say it's a pleasure probably to be in Switzerland right now with some free time and the ski slopes are probably calling. How is life post FS?
Yeah, no complaints. This is a good place, I think, to launch into retirement. Arriving in Switzerland right around wintertime, and I'm a skier and so is my wife. So, it's been fun. I've been trying to get out and explore mountains as much as I can. And I've been doing quite a bit of skiing.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Nice. So far, it's nice so to good. Have the free time to do that.
That's and right.
So let's go back a little bit and tell us how did you get interested in the Golden Visa program? Where did you start? Like, was this many years in the making? Like, you know, what kind of captured your imagination about it?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Well, as you mentioned in the intro, we did a tour in Portugal. Spent 4 years in Lisbon, and actually it was one of our favorite tours. It was just an incredible place, and it was our taste of living in Western Europe, because prior to that, we'd been in Russia, so European, but not Western. My wife had studied a bit in France in college, and I'd traveled through Europe, but this was like 4 years of living in Europe, and we just fell in love with Portugal and with just sort of the whole European experience. So since that tour, we've always toyed with the idea of, you know, maybe when we retire, we'd want to do part year somewhere in this part of the world. And that stuck with me. And I think actually the Portuguese Golden Visa, I'd heard about it off and on through the years, but it was one of the Foreign Service Facebook groups that hosted a webinar or like a call to talk specifically about the Portuguese Golden Visa. And I dialed in and I listened to another retired Foreign Service officer who was well into the process at that point. And the way he explained it, it just didn't sound that tough to do. I thought, wait, that's okay. It sounds really complicated.
Like, I can do that. Yeah.
Yeah, I can do
that.
Yeah. And so when I retired, I went back to Washington and actually this guy was living in the DC area. I'm not going to mention his name because I haven't asked him whether he's okay with that. But we met for coffee and he kind of walked me through it. And I thought, yeah, it's a long and somewhat convoluted process, but like everything, especially in the Foreign Service, you know, put one foot in front of the other and just focus on the next step. And pretty soon you're at the end. So I started down the path.
Everything is figure outable in a way, right?
Exactly. Just gotta don't look at the 29th step. Look at the first three steps.
Exactly. Yeah. Because I think people look at it and they think, wow, it seems really complicated. It seems like it's a lot of money.
Right.
So you met with this retired Foreign Service officer. You have coffee, and yeah. What does he tell you exactly that gets this process started for you?
Well, he walked me through sort of the macro level because there are lots of options, and I guess backing up just a step, Portugal is not the only European Golden Visa program that you can pursue. There are a number of European countries that offer these things called golden visas. Spain, Greece, Italy, Malta, even Switzerland, where I am now. Mm-hmm. I think Austria, Belgium, Ireland, Germany, and Bulgaria. But the Portuguese one is kind of the gold standard. I think it's the most transparent. It's been around for a long time now, about a decade. And I think it's sort of recognized by the OECD and the EU as sort of above board, legit, you know, there's no funny business. So it's more transparent. And the idea behind this golden visa is that you are, yeah, as you said, it costs money. You're buying a visa that then gives you resident status. It's a resident visa. Mm-hmm. And if you hold that visa for enough time, and each of those countries has different money thresholds for the buy-in and different tenure periods of how long you have to hold the visa. But at the end, it converts basically to a passport. And so that's the whole concept. And so he walked me through for Portugal's golden visa, the different options, because there are different options, different ways with different amounts and different investments to get the ball rolling.
And tell us a little bit more in detail about what those are. So if I'm like the average person, right? I mean, what kind of money are we talking about in order to invest? And where does that money go? Does it go to the government? Does it go into investments? Like, what kind of investments are there? Do you have a selection? Tell us a little bit more about, you know, kind of what are the options, at least in terms of Portugal, right? Because as you mentioned, all countries are a little bit different, but this is really about your story and your experience. And so how did you decide among what the investments were or what the options were, you know, and what was sort of your reasoning behind that decision?
Right. So, yeah, I will throw out some numbers, but that people are going to have to fact check them because A, I'm not sure I've got them all right. And B, the Portuguese Golden Visa just sort of overhauled a lot of their dollar thresholds on January 1.
Right. So it has changed since you were doing it initially.
Yeah. So I started last fall and I went as quickly as I could because I knew that starting January 1, all these dollar limits were going to go up. I think Portugal may be kind of phasing out the golden visa, and they're starting by basically making it a bit more expensive, but it's still accessible. I mean, to answer your question, the traditional way, the idea is that Portugal or any of these countries is trying to bring foreign investment and foreign capital, so money, into their economies. And a lot of these programs started, you know, during that sort of 2008 to 2011-ish recession.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most traditional way to go about the golden visa was through real estate. So the idea was you would, for Portugal, for example, you would buy a place like a house or a condo or an apartment or whatever, and buying that, and it used to be, I think, $350,000. Mm-hmm. This is where I'm going to get a little bit hung up on the numbers. It used to be 350,000 euros mm-hmm. if you were in urban areas, and then cheaper if you were in rural areas. And if you purchased that and did it through the golden visa process, which means you went through all the application hoops to get the golden visa and tied the real estate purchase to the golden visa application process, then you would be issued the visa. And then if you held that property for 5 years and held the visa for 5 years, you would be eligible to convert it. The success of the program has been enormous. And so I know that Portugal has now disallowed real estate purchases in the big cities like Lisbon, Porto, down south in the Algarve. Now I think you can only buy residential real estate on the islands that they hold, so the Azores and Madeira, and in designated interior regions of the country. And I believe the threshold is 500,000 euros now for residential real estate.
Because I can imagine, like, you know, somebody living in Lisbon that's a Portuguese citizen by birth, and they're like, hey, all these foreigners are coming in and they're buying up their real estate. And, you know, yes, it's a influx of money into the economy, but that's also adding additional competition, right, to real estate markets that are probably already tight, and especially in sort of the sought after areas. So, I mean, I can see how the government, you know, governments adjust over time, depending on, you know, where they want the dollars to flow, or in this case, euros, right?
Yeah, and that's precisely what happened. So the Portuguese real estate market, I mean, God, I wish I could go back in time and buy a house when we were posted there, because we lived there through the recession. We got there in 07 and left in 11. So we saw the bottom fall out of the global economy, but the Portuguese real estate market just collapsed. It has recovered in spades and has become exponentially more expensive. And believe it or not, as you said, a big driver of that, especially in the cities, has been this Golden Visa program. You've had Brits and Russians and Chinese and South Africans and Brazilians, not a lot of Americans actually, gobbling up beautiful and very affordable real estate in these amazing metropolitan areas of Portugal. And the result has been this overall rising tide of prices across the real estate market, which has caused a lot of consternation. And you're seeing a lot of newspaper articles in the press there and people complaining that, yeah, foreigners are snapping up all the properties. Locals are getting outpriced and outbid and having to move out of the big cities. And that's not a dynamic I think people maybe foresaw or wanted.
Not very politically feasible, right, to continue running the program the way. But that is not actually the option that you chose, right?
Right. So, and I'll just say one other thing. Although the prices went up, there are still projects in real estate to buy what they call rehab projects in rural and low density areas. The limit there was only 280,000 euros, and that has remained the same even after January 1. That's almost half the price of, you know, the 500,000 euro option to buy real estate in these other interior region cities. So I just want to throw that out there because I have a friend who's not in the Foreign Service. They're actually associated with the United Nations, who's pursuing the Portuguese Golden Visa through a rehab real estate development project in a rural area. And the buy-in for him is 280,000 euros. So it's a lot better. But yeah, back to what you were saying, the other way that you can do this, and this is the way that I chose to go, and the friend that I met for coffee was going, is that if you're not interested in buying actual real estate, you could invest your money in a qualified Golden Visa investment fund. And there are like maybe over a dozen, between a dozen and 20 of these investment funds that have been registered with the Portuguese government. And if a foreigner purchases shares in one of these funds, it counts as sort of parking money in the Golden Visa program. The beauty there is, like any investment fund, like if you were to invest in an investment fund in the United States, there's projected growth, and it depends on what the investment fund is putting their money in. I'd say the majority of those investment funds are kind of like REITs. They're invested in the real estate market in Portugal. And a lot of that is commercial. So a lot of the funds are taking investors' money and putting them toward building shopping centers and grocery stores and hospitals and student dorms, things like that. Some of them are residential. They're building apartment buildings and condo complexes in the major cities. The one that I found that was really interesting was actually a VC fund. It was a venture capital fund run by the largest Portuguese venture capital firm based in Lisbon called Iberia Capital. And they had a special fund that was not just for Golden Visa investors. It was a general fund that they were raising money from high net worth individuals and pooling money to invest in scale up companies. But they had registered it and qualified it as a GV qualified fund. And so I was able to put money. Well, that's where I would have put money.
Had I taken we won't get to that life. Part of the story just yet. But
yeah, we'll get there.
It's fascinating. So how exactly does it work? Is it, do you have to hire a company then that is sort of the intermediary between you and the Portuguese government? Or is there like a private sector component? How do all of these different players kind of, how does that money flow, right? So if I'm here in the United States and I'm the average American, and let's say I have $280,000 or $500,000, is it just cash? Do they want like a transfer of, you know, $500,000? That sounds a little scary, right? So what's the money line? Like, how do you trace it? Does it go, where does it go? Like once it leaves your bank account, essentially, or is there a company that helps you do this?
Yeah. So of course, with these amounts, there's a lot of nervousness and anxiety, and you want to make sure everything is completely above board. The beautiful thing is, yes, so you're going to want to work through an intermediary. I went with a lawyer, and there are lawyers in Lisbon who just really focus on this Golden Visa program. They're specialized, and it's been pretty profitable for them, and there's a steady stream of demand. So they're really, really good at it. I went with a lawyer who's actually listed on the U.S. Embassy's website. You know, they have a section of the website.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
They don't have the embassy's stamp of approval, as I'm sure you and others on the listening know. The embassy doesn't endorse, but they will list local business facilitators and legal offices and things like that. And this guy was listed there. He was great. He was absolutely great. He knew the system from A to Z. And so basically, yeah, there's an application process and there's a lot of paperwork that has to be done before you pull the trigger and transfer money over. The basic ABCs are you want to fill out the Golden Visa application and the lawyer steps you through that. That includes a lot of documenting. It's just, you know, they need an FBI check on you and your family members that are applying to make sure you're not a criminal. And that has to be apostilled, which is sort of the international version of a notary. Mm-hmm. They need your birth certificate. And if you're, you know, applying with your spouse, they need your marriage certificate. Those need to be originals and apostilled. So if your kids are wrapped into this and you're trying to get them the visa and the passports eventually as well, their birth certificates.
Also, yeah, lots also. Of documents. Yes.
You go through all these documents. And then once you have all of that in place, the lawyer, or you could have a consultant do this, but the lawyer was great. They will then apply to the Portuguese government to get you a Portuguese tax ID number. It's a pretty straightforward process. I mean, basically, once you give them everything they know they need, they can get that number fairly quickly. And once you have that Portuguese tax ID number, then you can have a bank account in Portugal opened in your name. And there are only two banks, as I understand it, that are qualified to be sort of Golden Visa banks for foreign citizens that are going through this process. One is BIG, Big, and the other, I think, was, I can't remember the name of the other one.
I'm curious about this banking piece. Did you have to show up in person to open this bank account? Because having opened a European bank account before, I can't imagine that you can do this online. You know, I mean, does the attorney help facilitate that? Like, how does that work?
Yes. So if you have a consultant or an attorney, you do a power of attorney for that person to sign on your behalf. And after they get your CIF, your Portuguese tax ID number, they will go and open the bank account. It's not quite so simple because you'll have a stack of papers you have to fill out for the bank, including a know your client, you know your customer background check form. And they also want to verify that, you know, where's the source of the money coming from? Is it your money? Are you a drug dealer? You know,
right. No, you know, anti-money laundering,
that's
right. Safeguards in there.
Yes. A lot of hoops. I think the other bank is Millennium, but, once you go through all the Portuguese Golden Visa paperwork, you get the tax ID number and you go through all the banking application paperwork and you get the bank open, then you have a Portuguese bank account. And so then it's just a matter of transferring the funds from your US account to the Portuguese account. And you wire that money. And I ended up using Wise, that app TransferWise. Now it's just called Wise. After going through and comparing what my bank would charge versus other wiring firms, Wise was actually the cheapest. And then you put your money and it shows up in your Portuguese bank account. And at that point,
that is great amounts of money, though, to be sending through some app on your phone. No, did you have like a moment where you were like, am I really going to push this button? Because I think I would have anxiety about it. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, I didn't, only because it was months of paperwork and FBI checks and apostilles.
You were like, I'm ready to do this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You just realize there aren't a lot of cracks for your money to fall through. It's a pretty regulated and organized system. It gave me a sense of confidence. The amount of paperwork I had to do gave me confidence that this isn't like, you know,
some fly by night operation.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Wise, is that WISE or do they spell it differently?
Yeah, Wise is WISE. It's a it's a great app to send money internationally very cheaply.
I learned something new today. You can send $500,000 through your phone, people.
That's right.
Just like that. You just push the button and there it goes.
Push a button. There goes all your money to a foreign country.
Yes. Yeah, so you send this money to your foreign bank account and then what happens to it from there? Then does it go directly to these private sector investments or does it go through some other channels before it ends up where it's supposed to go?
Had I seen this through to the end, I had interviewed the C-suite executives at this venture capital company over Zoom several times. So I had faith that this was also a legitimate, bona fide, you know, sort of solid place to park the money. So what I would have done at that point is told the venture capital company that the money is at my bank and now I want to purchase shares of the investment fund. And they would have facilitated that with my bank to convert the money into shares. And then the shares you hold for 5 to 7 years. And again, a lot depends on what you're investing in. And then the beauty of that, I mean, honestly, this VC fund had a really good track record. The company was good. And they were targeting 15 to 20% returns annually.
That's
and
crazy.
At the end of your 5 years, you get your initial capital back. You get the principal back, plus the passport. And I mean, 15 to 20%, it sounds extravagant, except when you look at investing in startup and scale-up companies in the VC world,
that's actually the growth potential is astronomical. Sure.
Yeah. So they were being, I'd say, conservative. When I talked to, you know, the executives at the company, you know, they sort of said, we hope to do much better than that. And their past funds have performed very well. It's a professional outfit, but there's always a risk. You could lose it all.
And so what happens to the dividends, right? What happens to this 15 to 20%? Is that just rolled up into all of the rest of the money and you get it after 5 years, or do you get distributions yearly? Do you see any of that money?
So many good questions, Tanya. Yes, you get the distributions yearly. And that's why it's important that you also, this is what was all new to me, you want to pick a fund that has registered in the U.S. as a PFIC QEF qualified fund.
Oh my.
And those are, it's like preferred foreign investment company, and QEF was qualified something fund.
Okay.
It means that they, if they are registered as PFIC QEF funds, that the dividends you get annually are treated as long-term capital gains and taxed at around 10 or 12%. If you don't do that, you could still invest in another Golden Visa investment fund, but if they're not registered that way, your annual dividends can be taxed at up to 50%.
Ouch. That's a really key difference there. So good to know.
Yeah. That was thanks to my coffee buddy. He had done a lot of homework on that because the tax implications are big.
They are big.
And yeah, that makes a big difference.
Are there firms here in the US that help people with that? I mean, it sounds like, you know, you had this like list of lawyers and you found this guy, but I mean, I guess when someone is overseas, how do you know, besides the embassy list or whatever it is, how do you know you can trust this person?
I don't think there are lawyers and facilitators in the US to help. Mm-hmm. And that's the $1 million question, sort of how do you vet the potential facilitator in Portugal when you're in the US and know that they're good. You know, you want references, you want to know people who are going through the process and ask them who they're using and how their experiences have been. Most importantly, you want to interview these people before you sign on the dotted line with any of them. You want to interview everybody. You want to interview the bank people. I did. I had Zoom calls with the lawyers. I had Zoom calls with the investment fund managers. I had Zoom calls with the bankers. You know, you want to, this is half a million euros.
Yeah. You did your due diligence.
Yeah.
And silly question, but what language were these interviews in? Since you said you spent some good time in Portugal, were you talking to them in Portuguese?
No, Portugal is one of those countries where they speak English incredibly well throughout the country. I mean, just it's so impressive. So everybody spoke English.
Okay. Well, that gives, I think, some security to make sure that everybody's on the same page. And, you know, when you're talking especially about like qualified funds and all of that, I mean, you know, FSI vocabulary sometimes is not enough to get you where you need to go to talk about advanced topics. But actually, so you never push the button on Wise to send your money. So there's a little bit of a twist to Dylan's story. So why don't you tell us how that came about?
Yeah. Yes, this was just really out of left field. I was ready to push the button. In fact, I got so far as I got my Portuguese tax ID number. I opened my bank account at Big Bank, and that was all in place. And so I'm not exaggerating. I was like 48 hours away from, I was on a ski vacation here in Switzerland, and I told my wife, you know, it was like a Friday or Saturday. I said, I'm going to send it on Monday. I just want to ski this weekend and I'll send it on Monday. And that weekend I got an email from the US Citizen and Immigration Service from an archive search that I ordered a year ago and had completely forgotten about.
what are the odds?
I mean, honestly, the timing couldn't have been more coincidental. Yeah, about a year ago, before I even started on this Portuguese golden visa thing, I was already thinking, boy, it'd be neat to get European citizenship when I retire and for all these other reasons. And I'd asked my mom about my about her father, about my grandfather, because he was born in Italy. He was born in Naples. And I thought, boy, you know, if my grandfather is born in Italy, can I qualify for Italian citizenship? She had no idea. I had no idea. As I kind of dug into it and read about how it might work, it all came down to dates. It all what mattered were dates. When did my grandfather become an American? Was it after or before he married my grandmother? Was it after or before he, you know, they had gave birth to my mom, blah, blah, blah. And I had no idea what the dates were. So I put in, I paid $75 on the USCIS website and ordered an archive search to find out when did my grandfather become an American. And, you know, it's like sending $75 off to a black hole. And I just literally forgot about it. I mean, they
sorry, USCIS listeners out there.
Sorry. Apologies to our government colleagues at USCIS. I know they're overwhelmed and overworked. So yeah, TikTok, you know, I just assumed whatever, I'm sure it's not going to work anyway. And so I went down this path with the Portuguese golden visa. And again, just days before I pulled the trigger on this transfer, I got the email back from USCIS. And it turns out that my grandfather was still Italian when he married my grandmother. Even though he was living in the United States and they got married in California, he had not become American yet. Mm. And so by Italian law, my grandmother, even though she was Irish, inherited his Italianness. And so she then passed it on to my mom, even though she had no idea. My mom's passed it on to me. I just have to claim it. So that is now the process that I'm going through. I froze the Portuguese golden visa process and I've switched gears and I'm now pursuing through the, you know, bloodline. I'm pursuing the Italian option.
Talk about serendipity. Wow. I mean, I don't know if it was the skiing and you're like, oh, I'll just wait. Or if it was just, I mean, cause like a whole year later and the timing, right? Like what an incredible story. I'm curious. In terms of costs, if you don't mind sharing, like what does it cost to hire a lawyer to help you, like in, like just say Portugal, right? Obviously each country is going to be a little bit different, but to give listeners a general idea of like, what does it actually cost to go through this process? What are the parts that where you have to pay, right up until obviously you, you know, push the button on the Wise app for your account, but like leading up to that, like what are some of the costs that you incur?
Right. So I have a spreadsheet I did and I don't have it next to me, but ballparking it, there are certain fees. If you go this Portuguese golden visa route that are non-negotiable, they're just part of the application process. And some of them are annual fees, you know, the golden visa annual fee, it's a few thousand bucks, $2,000 or $3,000 a year, I think. Your lawyer will charge a tax representation fee to represent you and file all the paperwork. Annually. There is a golden visa renewal fee that I think is every 2 years. It depends a little bit on, is it just you going through it or is it you, your wife and your two kids or, you know, how many people? Ballpark, I think if I remember correctly, was sort of soup to nuts over the course of the 5 year process that we would have held the golden visa. I was looking before they raised the prices, my buy-in was 350,000 euros. Mm-hmm. Now it's 500,000. Above that 350,000, it was like another 60,000.
Okay.
For all the processing and application and tax ID rep fees over the course of that 5 years. So not insignificant, but you know, it wasn't like it doubled the cost.
And that 60,000 you said is spread out over the 5 years leading up until the point where you're actually sending your investment money. What are those fees like? Are they like 3, 5, 10,000, roughly speaking?
Yeah, it was like, yeah, I mean, this would have been for me and the two kids. It was probably, yeah, like 15-ish.
Okay. All right.
I'm kind of trying to remember, but I think that's about right. Yeah. And some fees are negotiable, like the lawyer or the consultant that you hire to shepherd you through the process is going to say, and this is my fee. And that, of course, you can say, well let's work a deal.
Well, that's a little high.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you can, wow, okay.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's some wiggle room. Yeah.
Interesting. Going back a little bit, I'm actually curious, when you were looking at the different investments, was it clear to you? Like you said, you chose this venture capital firm. Was it very clear to you, like, this was a clear winner? Or were there a lot of good different investments and you just felt that particular offering was better than others? How'd you make that decision?
Yeah, I had a short list of three or four. So there were a lot of good funds. And even when I narrowed it down to the ones that I thought were the best, there were options. This was the only venture capital fund. And I liked the fact that they were well-established, extremely professional, had a good track record, and were targeting high returns. To be honest, though, like if you were not so, if you were more risk averse, the real estate funds, especially the commercial real estate funds, they were targeting 4 to 8% returns per year, which is still really decent. And again, you get your principal capital back at the end of all of this. So they were safer bets, and they were also good professional companies with projects that, you know, some of them had already begun. So, you know, they're not pie in the sky, just on paper type projects. Some of them were already sort of well under construction. So yeah, it was tough. It was tough. At the end of the day, I kind of looked at it as, I mean, as you know, Tanya, I'm invested in real estate already. And we have good market exposure, you know, in equity markets. So to me, the appeal of putting money in a venture capital company and trying my hand at investing in some high growth early stage companies was like, ooh, this is a good way to diversify our portfolio.
That's appealing. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're rounding out your portfolio with different things and also international investments as well, right? Not just US based.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's how we ended up deciding on that. Yeah.
So question. So you, going back to this discovery email from USCIS, right? So you're now in the process of getting Italian citizenship, and how does that work for people who might want to try this too?
Yeah. So the big appeal there was, you know, the price difference. So because I believe I have a claim to Italian citizenship through descent, it's a really kind of straightforward process I'm going through. And there's a law firm in New York that specializes in this. This is all they do, is Italian citizenship assistance. In fact, that's their name, ICA. And they are charging about 8,000 euros for the entire process. So, you know, when I compare that to what we were looking at on the Portuguese side, I thought, this is kind of a no-brainer. But the way it works is Italian, and there are others. I mean, if any of the listeners have any Italian heritage, it's worth looking into, because I know Ireland, which is my other grandparent, has Irish roots. A lot of these countries don't require that it just be your parents. It can be grandparents and even great grandparents. If you can prove that they were born in Europe and then that they didn't break the chain of citizenship eligibility, and that's the million-dollar question, was, as I said, with all the dates, then all you have to do is basically cough up a ton of documents again, you know, birth certificates, marriage certificates, death certificates, all that kind of stuff, show that chain of sort of citizenship custody, and then take it to, in my case, the Italian government. And I'm not really applying at that point for Italian citizenship. I'm sort of claiming that I have a right to it. And then they give it their stamp of approval, hopefully, and then you're done. So it's much more straightforward. The beauty there is also I will then be able to pass it to my kids. And so they'll get it as well. My wife, not so much. She'll have to wait. And then once I have Italian citizenship, she can apply for it as a spouse.
Excellent. So it really worked out really well for you, at least, you know, on multiple fronts, right? And I guess now the question is, now you got some money to invest. Yeah. And where do you put it, right? But hey, it's a good problem to have.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we had cordoned off all this money, and again, 48 hours away from sending it to Portugal, and now I'm sitting on it. So we have been slowly parking it in different places. Again, trying to keep the portfolio diverse, and you know that I have a proclivity for real estate, and want to keep that moving. So, I mean, you've been helpful in that regard, we're just keeping an eye on the market and looking at cost averaging down and all that good stuff. So,
awesome. We'll see what happens. Yeah. I mean, that's a wonderful story. I'm like super happy for you. I'm curious, as a parting question, how is life post foreign service? How's the transition been?
It's, you know, I'm sure it's different for everybody. It's been great for me. I mean, arguably, of course, I'm still in the honeymoon phase because I fully retired in November and it's only January. So, no, I'm loving it. I'm loving it. I'm busy and active with stuff that I want to do, maybe rather than stuff I have to do or that somebody's telling me to do. So that's quite liberating. And of course, I'm in a new country. We just moved to Switzerland and I got here in November. So exploring and being outdoors and seeing a lot of friends. And we do have friends across Europe. So we're doing quite a bit of traveling and spending time with the kids. I mean, all that sort of normal stuff. And then there is now that extra time to focus on like this, managing our finances, pursuing European citizenship, et cetera, et cetera. It feels good to be able to sort of in a more directed and sort of full-time way, focus on stuff that I feel like is important for me and our family, and you know, and ultimately the community. I mean, I have a nice list and have started reaching out to places to volunteer here in Geneva, and there's no sort of dearth of opportunities there. And yeah, just, you know, it's been fun. I hope it stays like this.
Honestly, thank you so much for taking the time to explain to us how, you know, your process with the Golden Visa program. And I think our listeners will get a lot of benefit out of it. And we wish you luck on the next steps to Italian citizenship. And you'll be enjoying the ski slopes there at some point, too. So thank you so much, Dylan. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tanya. It's been a pleasure.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.